Welcome to Attack the System Radio, a program dedicated to pan-anarchism against the state and pan-secessionism against the empire, with Keith Preston. Politicians hide themselves away. They only started the war. Why should they go out to fight? They leave their all to the poor. Yeah.
Hello? And welcome to Attack the System. I'm your host, Keith Preston. This is being recorded on Saturday evening, June the 8th, 2013. Tonight, I want to talk about something that should be foremost on the minds of most anti-state radicals, and that's the need for a revolution in the world of law, in the realm of law. And I'll elaborate on that a little bit tonight. But I want to begin with a quote that I found on a website that's run by an anarchist by the name of Jad Davis. This is from jad-davis.com, an anarchist by the name of Jad Davis. And on this, he's quoting Otto von Bismarck. Otto von Bismarck said that crowned heads, wealth, and privilege may well tremble should ever again the black and red and gold unite. And what Jad Davis is using this quote to illustrate, of course, is the fact that what really keeps radicals from achieving their goals as much as anything else is the kind of sectarian divisiveness that we have found that we frequently find within the ranks of radical movements. And if there's one message more than any other that I have tried to advance through some of my own projects, like American Revolutionary Vanguard and AttackTheSystem.com, is that if anti-state radicals, if radicals from the entire spectrum of anarchists and libertarians and decentralists and so forth, ever wish to achieve any goals at all in the real world, if they wish to ever have any real world political influence, rather than simply being a movement of philosophers and ideological enthusiasts, then we have to find ways of uniting all of our divergent factions around issues of interest and issues of common interest, and working around our differences. And, of course, we can easily identify some of our common issues, and those are things like international relations, foreign policy, our shared opposition to imperialism and to the global plutocratic capitalist economy, our common opposition to the police state, the surveillance state, and so forth. Of course, there's a lot of areas where we disagree. We disagree on a lot of hyphenated brands of anarchism. We disagree on a lot of cultural and social issues. We disagree on a lot of economic theories or what ideal economics arrangements might be. But there are ways of working around that, and that's why I've in the past promoted ideas like pan-secessionism or radical decentralization. The purpose of all of these concepts is to help anti-state radicals work around their differences and build unity around areas of agreement. Now, I want to talk a little bit about this issue of law and the need for a revolution in the realm of law. Of course, the law itself, the concept of the law, and when I say the law, I mean codified edicts that are decreed by the state. Anarchists have long been skeptical of the law and had a negative view of the law, because the standard anarchist view is that the law simply reflects the interests and priorities of those who hold power at the particular moment, that the law is set up not to advance the interest of the public at large or the people at large or everyone in society, but the law is set up to advance those who are in power politically, those who dominate the economy, the ruling class, and things like that. Of course, the conventional view of law that we get from the state itself, from the educational system, from the media, and so forth, is that the law is there for your protection, the law is there to protect society, the law is there to keep people from preying on each other, and of course there's some truth to that. I mean, I'm not denying that there's no truth at all to that. But law is really much more than that. Law really does reflect the values and interests of those who hold power. It really does reflect the objectives of the state. It really does serve to protect and advance the interests of the ruling class. This is a standard anarchist critique of law. It goes all the way back to the earliest anarchist thinkers like Proudhon and Bakunin and so forth. So the subject of law and how we might go about reorganizing law in the event of an anarchist-led revolution is something we need to give a great deal of thought to, because it's a very complicated issue. It's an issue that has many, many different dimensions to it. Now, modern libertarians have come up with a concept called the non-aggression principle. The non-aggression principle, it's also been called the zero aggression principle. And this really is just a more fancy way of stating the old adage that your right to swing your fist stops where someone else's nose starts. The idea that, generally speaking, people should be left alone to do what they want and to mind their own business, so long as they don't intrude upon the equal liberty of others. One of the early anarchist thinkers, Benjamin Tucker, used to talk about the idea of equal liberty, the idea that, you know, everyone has the equal right to live their own life however they choose. They just can't step on other people. And while certainly it's certainly true that trying to form a system of law based on the non-aggression principle, it has its problematical areas, and I'll talk about that a little bit tonight. It also seems to be a much improved basis for law over what is the basis of law in our present societies. For example, with mass democracy of the type that we have in most of the modern societies, there really is no basis for law at all. And now, in some societies, there is a consistent basis for law, whatever you think of the particular laws that exist. For instance, in an Islamic society, the laws are based on the teachings of the Islamic faith, the Quran, and traditions and so forth within Islam. And, of course, there's all kinds of differences of opinion about how Islamic law should be applied or interpreted, but there's still some consistent, some solid basis for law. The same would be true in some other kind of religion-based or tradition-based system like Christianity or Judaism or Hinduism. And it's also true that with a system like Marxism, there's some consistent basis for law in the sense that everything, law is geared towards the advancement of the interest of the Marxist state. Now, of course, being anarchists, being libertarians, being anti-statists, we may be inclined to criticize some of those kinds of systems, theocratic systems and Marxist systems and so forth, and rightfully so. But it is true that there is some consistent basis for law in systems like that. But with mass democracy of the type that we're more familiar with, there is no basis for law. Law simply reflects the ongoing struggle between political interest groups, and if you actually take a look at how the law is written in modern mass democratic societies, we see that law has no consistency to it. Law has no coherence to it. It's really just an incoherent collection of bits of legislation that continue to be piled on top of each other, and it assumes a very schizophrenic character, because law in one instance is written to satisfy this political interest group. It's written in another situation to satisfy another political interest group. And the law just becomes a hodgepodge of conflicting ideas that collectively make no sense. And in the long run, it has the effect of creating disrespect for law, because anyone with any ounce of intelligence can look at the law and see that that's all the law really is. The law really is just a hodgepodge of conflicting bits of legislation that has no coherence to it, no consistency to it. It's simply the arbitrary whims of the people who have power at the moment and whatever political interest groups are behind them. So, in other words, law in a democratic state is really just a substitute for a civil war. It's really just sort of a low-intensity civil war in many ways. The conservative parties get elected. They pass some laws designed to advance conservative interests. The liberal parties get elected, and they enact some liberal laws, and then the other side comes back and tries to undo what the other side has done, and so forth, and it just goes back and forth. There really is no basis for consistency or coherence in law in a mass democracy because there is no consensus on shared values. There's no consensus on how the state or the political institutions, the legal institutions, ought to be operated. There's no consensus on what their purpose is. So, with the libertarian concept of the non-aggression principle, we do have some solid foundation for what law might be in a libertarian society, in an anarchist society. That doesn't mean that the non-aggression principle is something that's somehow sacred. For instance, there are some in the libertarian milieu who hold, and you find this among left and right-wing libertarians as well, but there are some who hold to this concept of natural rights, this idea that just because of our nature as human beings or whatever we are, we have these rights. And you find this idea is rooted, of course, in classical liberal philosophy, going all the way back to John Locke. John Locke talked about the natural rights of man, and then you see that kind of thing getting written into the American Declaration of Independence. It also finds its way into the documents of the French Revolution, the rights of man, the natural rights of man, and so forth. Now, my own view on that, and by the way, a lot of modern libertarians and left and right continue to hold to this theory. I know people personally who do, and even some of the major thinkers in the libertarian tradition in modern times, like say Murray Rothbard or someone like that, held to this theory. Now, I do not hold to the idea of natural rights myself. I think that's just a kind of quasi-religious, kind of quasi-metaphysical fiction, what Max Stirner would have called a spook. But I do think the concept of natural rights might be a type of useful mythology. Georges Sorel, one of the neo-Machiavellian elite theorists of the early to mid-20th century, argued that political populations, that is, subjects of a particular state or citizens in a particular society, tend to be more motivated by myths than by facts. And that is, what motivates them is the popular mythology of their own society and culture, not necessarily concrete, rational facts. And we see that in our own society as well, in the United States. We see this ideas like American exceptionalism and all sorts of similar concepts that, while some of the claims behind them might be somewhat shallow or somewhat dubious, they are a strong motivating factor for many people, even beyond what might be some more rational motivating factors that people might have. So natural rights might be helpful mythology, but it's, again, in my view at least, it's only mythology. But out of this concept of natural rights or abstract individual rights, there is this concept called the non-aggression principle, which basically means I'll leave you alone and if you leave me alone. And that's a fairly practical foundation for a system of common law in a particular society. The idea that people should just go their own way, mind their own business, just don't infringe on the so-called rights of others. Now, among anarchists and libertarians, there is a lot of disagreement about how this concept of the non-aggression principle ought to be applied. There are some libertarians, for instance, who are more leftward leaning, who say that, non-aggression principle is not good enough. There should be something called that they call a non-oppression principle, where because they say that there are forms of oppression other than aggression. And you know, without getting into some of the details of that, you know, I think on one hand I understand the arguments for that point of view, but I also think that it has the effect of diluting the concept of aggression. You know, what separates libertarianism from other political philosophies is its emphasis on coercion imposed by the state. That it's the state that claims a monopoly on the use of physical violence, of physical coercion. It's the state that can put people in jail and execute people and so forth. And while I would agree that there can be forms of oppression that don't necessarily involve direct physical violence, like exploitation of workers by a corporation or something like that, I do think it's a mistake to equate all of that with physical aggression. But that's one of the many disputes that libertarians and anarchists have within their own ranks. But even within the concept of this idea of the non-aggression principle, we find disagreement among libertarians as to how the non-aggression principle should be applied. For instance, on the question of abortion, I've talked about that on some previous programs, but it's an issue that really is one of the most divisive issues in our own society, and it's divisive among libertarians as well. And there's some people who argue that abortion constitutes aggression. I don't know if it's still around or not, but there used to be a group called Libertarians for Life, which was a pro-life libertarian group that argued that abortion is, in fact, aggression against an unborn fetus, which in their view is a person. Of course, there are other libertarians who've taken precisely the opposite argument. Murray Rothbard, for instance, argued that a fetus is essentially a trespasser on the property rights of the woman that's carrying it. When a woman aborts an unwanted fetus, it's really no different than ejecting a trespasser from your property. And Rothbard's position on this was extremely controversial. Rothbard himself was somewhat conservative-leaning on a lot of cultural issues, but on this issue, a lot of conservatives ended up getting offended by some of his views. Another issue is immigration. I recently posted some items on attackthesystem.com, a point-counterpoint debate between libertarians who are proponents of open borders, so-called open borders immigration, and libertarians who are in favor of restricted immigration on the grounds that in a state-dominated society that open borders essentially amounts to forced association. This is an issue. I mean, for the sake of this discussion here, I'm not really taking anyone's side on this, but this is an issue that is very divisive among libertarians and even among anarchists. And I don't really think that there's any one quote unquote right answer to this question from an anarchist perspective, because I think a lot of it comes down to the question of who would have jurisdiction over what I call the means of immigration in a stateless society. Immigration isn't just something that happens in a vacuum. Immigration requires the use of a lot of public or private or whatever resources, airlines, railroad tracks, waterways, highways, and so forth. My view is that in a stateless society, whatever kinds of communities or groups or individuals or whatever that had jurisdiction over the means of immigration, whether it's an airport or a public highway or a coastal border area or whatever, there would probably be a lot of variation in terms of who was allowed entry and who wasn't. For instance, I don't think the absence of the state really solves the question. For instance, let's assume that the anarchist revolution in Spain had been successful over a long period of time, the anarchist revolution that took place in the 1930s. This was a case where anarchists organized their own militias and fought a two-front civil war. And I could very easily see an anarchist militia federation guarding its own borders against unwanted immigration. That's not to say that necessarily would happen, but it certainly could happen. And of course, it's also true that a stateless territory could indeed have open immigration, and you could see people from all over the place coming in and even setting up, you know, shanties on public streets and so forth. You know, it could go either way. So there's no real answer to this question. It all just depends on the opinions that individuals and groups develop for themselves. Other issues concerning different interpretations of the non-aggression principle are things like children's rights. Once again, Rothbard was really big on the right of children to run away from home. As far as I can tell from reading Rothbard's writings, there would be no prohibition specifically in a libertarian society against even things like child labor or child pornography, even, or child prostitution. Rothbard was, you know, in favor of the right of children to run away from home. He was opposed to child labor laws, and he never really said anything about things like the age of consent for sexual relationships. But I got the impression from reading his work that he probably would have opposed those. At least, I mean, not that he would have endorsed behavior associated with that, but on a theoretical level and in terms of a legal meta system, Rothbard, you know, took a pretty libertine, I suppose, approach to the question of children's rights. And of course, there's other people who make precisely the opposite argument that children are. Benjamin Tucker, for instance, argued that children were really just the property of their parents, even to the point of arguing that parents had the right to kill unwanted children. And most, I think, most libertarians, most anarchists would probably take positions in between these extremes. That children have some rights as individuals, and certainly the right not to be killed by parents or anyone else, that parents who bring children into the world have some obligation for care of children. But this is a controversial issue among libertarians on which there is no agreement. And also there's an issue of animal rights. There are some people in libertarian camps who argue that animals are simply property, and you should be able to do to animals whatever you want so long as you own the animal. You can torture an animal to death. You can use animals in dog fights and things like that if you want. I have come across other anarchists and libertarians who believe that animals are the equivalent of people and should essentially have the same kind of rights as people do. Probably most libertarians and most anarchists are somewhere between those extremes as well, but we do see the kind of polarized opinion that we can find on these kinds of issues. Another issue that's very divisive among different types of anarchists and libertarians is the question of property rights, about how, for example, land ownership or ownership of productive property should be allocated. Of course, there are some that have sort of a Lockean view, sort of a free enterprise with potential unlimited accumulation. That, you know, American-style libertarians tend to have a view like that. There are others that take a somewhat more socialistic view of property rights, or arguing for property ownership based on possession and use, you know, usufructuary rights. There are others that have a middle-of-the-road point of view, kind of like what Henry George had about the land tax and so forth. So, again, that's a very controversial subject. And then another issue is the environment. What about, for example, polluters, businesses that are engaged in pollution? Are they simply practicing free enterprise? Are they engaged in aggression against commonly owned property like the atmosphere or whatever? So there are a lot of different disputes about how the non-aggression principle should be applied. But with the non-aggression principle, we at least do have some foundation for a system of libertarian law. And of course, there's a lot of other categories. When we think about all the different categories of law that there are, there's criminal law, there's civil law, there's traffic law, there's family law. We can go through and take a look at some of the different kinds of controversies and conflicts and problematical situations that might arise when we try to apply the non-aggression principle to all those areas. For instance, in child custody, let's say you have a couple that has a child together, a man and a woman, and then their relationship ends, and let's say the relationship turns sour and they become enemies with each other. Well, what happens to any children that they created together? Who gets custody of those children? Who has jurisdiction over those children? Rothbard, I believe, argued that the mother always had first right to children because the child was simply her property right. Her right to her children was her property right because her own body or whatever produced it. Now, there are other people, for example, I've come across some libertarians who say that if a woman has an abortion, the man should have some say-so in that because he has a potential property right or jurisdictional right over his own children or potential children. Now, there's also the issue of whether to what degree parents are required to provide support for their children. You know, I've come across libertarians who believe parents should be allowed to starve their children to death. I mean, not that most parents want to do that, but but theoretically, legally, they should be able to do that if they want, simply by just not feeding children. Now, of course, there are other people who have the view that children should have equal rights against their parents. Should be able to, if I've come across anarchists who believe that if, dad tells you to take out the garbage, you should have the right to tell your dad to, get lost or whatever. But I think probably most people have views that are somewhere between these kinds of extremes. Then there's issues like drunken driving. If you drive drunk but don't actually hit anyone, have you committed a crime? Some people say yes, because that's reckless endangerment, and the fact that you didn't hurt anybody was mere good luck. Other people say no identifiable injured person, then there's no victim. So a lot of different things to consider. There's also the question of what kind of legal institutions a stateless society would have. There are some libertarians who accept the concept of public law, both left and right libertarians, and there's others who wish to have a system of entirely private law. Of course, there's also, that gets us into the question of anarchism versus minarchism, about whether or not government should be, can or should be completely abolished, versus minarchism, the idea of, well, maybe this could be a very limited government with a bare minimum of powers and maintaining a system of public law. Just for the maintenance of civil order and so forth might be one of those functions. And I think that when it comes to that debate between anarchism and minarchism and related to that private versus public law, or even in the economic realm of libertarian so-called capitalism or libertarian so-called socialism, left and right libertarianism, I don't know that I think that these kinds of disputes are necessarily as important as the question of scale. Of course, I tend to be very much oriented towards the idea that decentralization almost always is superior to centralization. And I think that in institutions of scale or communities of scale, political units of scale, that the very respective problems that might arise from different types of political systems or different types of economic systems or different types of legal systems might be somewhat mitigated by the issue of scale. For instance, if we look around the world, we see, as I've pointed out before, that there are a lot of different micronations and so forth that seem to function fairly well most of the time, relatively high level of peace and prosperity and freedom and so forth. So there seems to be something to be said for the issue of scale. I know there was an anarchist thinker by the name of Leopold Kohr. He wrote a classic book called The Breakdown of Nations, where he talked a little bit about this, about how that a lot of problems are simply caused because things are too big. Kirkpatrick Sale had a work called Human Scale that came out in 1980, where he addressed some of these same ideas. So I think questions of scale are very important, and questions of scale can help us to deal with some of these other issues. For example, it's presumably different kinds of communities in a stateless society would have different systems of law reflecting their community values, conflicting views over things like children's rights, animal rights, the environment, property rights, abortion, immigration, things like that. Now, it's also true, however, that there are to be certain things that all of us as anarchists, all of us as libertarians, all of us as anti-state radicals should be able to agree on as common principles or as things that ought to be of concern when it comes to this question of law. What kind of laws a free society, a libertarian society, should have. One of those things is the repeal of victimless crime laws or so-called consensual crime laws. There was a book that came out about 20 years ago that was written by Peter McWilliams. Peter McWilliams was a libertarian writer who died of some serious health issues, and his death was hastened by his treatment at the hands of the legal system itself, which is ironic. And without going into the details of all that, it's a rather unfortunate story, Peter McWilliams, the fate of Peter McWilliams. That's something you may want to look up if you want to know more about it. But Peter McWilliams wrote a book back in the early 1990s called Ain't Nobody's Business If You Do. Ain't Nobody's Business If You Do. It's, I think the title was taken from an old Billie Holiday song, I think it was. Peter McWilliams wrote a very lengthy book talking about the concept of consensual crimes and the way in which on a regular basis there are hundreds of thousands of people every year who are arrested or imprisoned for so-called crimes that do not involve harm, direct harm to any other person. The most obvious example, of course, and well-known example is drug use. There's also things like other vices, sexual vices and gambling and things like that. There's also things like getting a ticket for not wearing a motorcycle helmet or a safety belt. A lot of different things that come under the category of consensual crimes, victimless crimes. And, of course, libertarians have long been outspoken opponents of these kinds of things. And I think that one thing all of us as anarchists, as libertarians, ought to be able to unite around is the need to repeal laws that criminalize consensual adult conduct and create these massive prison populations like we have in the United States, and the police state that's built up around the enforcement of some of these kinds of laws. Another issue is self-defense, and self-defense rights are something that libertarians also disagree on. To what degree, how far you can go to claim self-defense. For example, if someone murders someone in your family and you kill them in retaliation, is that self-defense or is that vigilante murder or is that defending your family? Is that vigilante murder? There are some people who say it is. There are some people who say it's not. But most libertarians generally believe in the right of self-defense. And I think this is an issue that is widely ignored because from what I have seen of self-defense law, at least in the United States, I haven't studied it in other places, but I imagine there's similar problems elsewhere. Self-defense law in some places is barely existent. It barely exists at all. It's really sort of like mandatory pacifism in many ways. So I think this is something we definitely need to look at. We need to look at the idea of revising self-defense law so that the individual has a full right of self-defense if someone acts aggressively against them. I think another area we should probably look at would be the bail system, the system of bail that's used to detain people accused of a crime. There's a great deal of abuse of that system. There are a lot of people who were arrested for petty things under dubious pretenses and are kept in jail for weeks or even months awaiting trial simply because they can't afford bail. A lot of poor people who are accused of something that's fairly petty or something that ends up getting dismissed when they go to court end up staying in jail for quite some time. Simply because they can't afford bail. So perhaps the bail system is something that needs to be looked at and reformed. There's also the question of how to go about dealing with crimes and criminal behavior. And this is something that anarchists and libertarians disagree among themselves fairly consistently. I've raised this issue with a lot of different anarchists and libertarians over the years and gotten a wide variety of responses to this question of how should criminal types be dealt with in a libertarian society and in an anarchist society. And when I say criminal types, I don't mean anyone that the state simply declares to be a criminal, but a criminal more in the common sense, somebody that's a habitual thief, robber, doesn't respect the rights of other people and things like that. I've heard some libertarians say that people like that should be sent to penal colonies. I've heard other people say they should be given psychiatric treatment. Some people, some libertarians are for the death penalty, others are not. There's a lot of variations on this. As far as the foundation for criminal justice, there's a lot of different theories there. There's some libertarians that are in favor of a restorative or restitutive system of justice where somebody does something wrong to somebody else that the way it's addressed is through trying to restore the victim or compensate the victim as much as possible. There are some other libertarians who have a retributive view of justice that's about, basically getting even with the offender. And these are important issues to consider, how we would go about penalizing or dealing with criminals in a libertarian society or in a stateless society, because it's quite likely there will always be crime. It's quite likely there will always be aggressive, antisocial personalities. There are some anarchists, particularly anarchists of the left, who argue that crime basically can be attributable to social causes, and I'm somewhat skeptical of that. I mean, having known a whole lot of serious, hardcore criminals myself, I'm somewhat skeptical that kind of thing is really caused by things like bad environment, bad upbringing, bad education, and so forth. I mean, I think there are some people that are just predatory, aggressive people and probably born that way. That's just their destiny to be that. So how does everyone else go about protecting themselves from people like that? That's the big question. There's also other issues as far as reforming existing legal institutions. You know, regardless of what kind of institutions of law we might have in the future, what about something like jury nullification? There's a big among libertarians in the United States. There's a big movement towards jury nullification, where juries will simply nullify overly oppressive laws. And this is becoming controversial because a lot of courts don't really want this movement to develop and go anywhere for obvious reasons. I've heard of prosecutors trying to bring criminal charges against members of juries who've actually exercised jury nullification on grounds that they were, tampering with a jury or, things like that. There's also the issue of what kind of legal institutions we would have in a stateless society. Would we have public courts like we do now? Would we have common law courts? Would we have entirely private courts? Would we have popular tribunals? Would we have systems of arbitration? Would we have disputes of a legal or quasi-legal nature settled by tribal elders? And there's a lot of different directions we can go in that. We can go with that. I think that the important question is one of scale. Probably different kinds of communities would have different answers to that question, and different groups of anarchists, different groups of libertarians, and so forth would have different systems for themselves. One issue that I'm interested in is the question of what to do about the huge prison population we have in the United States at the present time, and which doesn't really show any sign of abating in any serious way. At some point in the future, let's say we're able to carry out an anarchist or libertarian-led anti-state revolution in the United States, what will we do about the millions of people who are currently being held in detention facilities of some type? And of course, my view is that there should be amnesty for most people who are being held in state detention facilities. Certainly, people who are being held for victimless crimes,
for crimes involving actual self-defense, obviously things involving wrongful conviction or excessive punishment. Now, one thing I think is actually interesting, and this is something that isn't very well known, but when the Iraq War began, right before the Iraq War began, back in early 2003, Saddam Hussein actually implemented a prisoner amnesty program where most prisoners were released. I think as a general rule, prisoners were released on the condition that they make restitution for victims. I believe, in terms, for example, if you stole from someone, you had to pay back the damages or whatever. And I think murderers even were granted a pardon if the if the victim's mother agreed to a pardon. I think was the standard. So that, Saddam Hussein, not exactly a liberal guy, but this was a fairly interesting program he implemented, and it may be something we might actually want to take a look at when it comes to developing a revolutionary program in our own society. In our own societies, for dismantling the police state apparatus, for dismantling the massive prison industrial complex, and deciding what to do with all the people who are currently being held in those facilities. And of course, there's also the question of what kind of crime control systems we would have in future societies, not just in terms of courts and law and so forth, but would there be police departments? Would there be sheriffs? Would there be constables? Would we rely on militias or citizen posses or neighborhood watch systems or things like that? Those are all things to consider. And once again, I think different kinds of communities would have different types of systems. Now, if we are talking about having a revolution, a revolution in a lot of different areas, political, economic, and so forth, but also in the realm of law, one question that remains is, what about the presence of what we might call unlibertarian or even illiberal elements in society? And what I mean by that is, let's say that all the different types of anti-state radicals collectively can become a political majority or something close to it. It still would remain the true that we would have to share space in society with people of other values and other belief systems. Even if we were largely successful at rewriting legal codes around the concept of the non-aggression principle, there would still be other people out there that might have different sets of values. For instance, just ordinary liberals and ordinary conservatives. When I was some years ago, I used to always hear it said that liberals are pretty good on some civil liberties issues, while conservatives are better on others. For example, it used to be in the United States that liberals tended to be better on First Amendment rights, what we call the First Amendment rights in the United States, which are the right of free speech, freedom of the press, separation of church and state, and things like that. Whereas conservatives, it was always said, tend to be better on the Second Amendment rights, which are the right to bear arms. And then liberals, it was considered, were better on things like due process rights, the rights of the accused, and so forth. Conservatives tended to be better on things like private property rights and things of that nature. I think that that distinction has been blurred somewhat in more recent times, and largely because of political correctness. I think a lot of liberals have moved away from some of their older, more civil libertarian orientation towards this idea of political correctness. I'll talk a little bit more about that in a moment as well. But it remains that the case that even if we're able to carry out a far-reaching revolution in the field of law, it still is going to be true that we're going to have to share space with people with other beliefs, other values. For instance, social conservatives. Most conservatives in the United States, I don't know about other parts of the world, but in the United States, American-style conservatives tend to have a fairly, schizophrenic in some ways. Maybe that's overly harsh, but fairly schizophrenic set of values, in the sense that on one hand they tend to pride themselves on their belief in individualism and constitutional rights and things of that nature, and in some cases they can take very hardcore ultra-libertarian views on certain things, like for example the right to bear arms. On the other hand, though, they can also be rather authoritarian in other areas, particularly when it comes to things like personal morals and vices. You know, there are some conservatives out there who think that things like drug use or homosexuality or pornography or prostitution and other vices like gambling, as well as things like abortion, they think these things are just so awful that they have to be prohibited. There's just no way that society or the law or whatever can ever tolerate these things. That seems to be a fairly strong strand with a lot of American conservatives. I'm not sure what the reason for that is, whether it's religion or whether it's a cultural thing or you know, the roots in Protestantism or whatever. But that strand is there. And on the other side of the fence, you have liberals who are the same way. Liberals talk a great deal about freedom of choice. They're big on privacy rights and things like that. And they'll often frame a lot of the rights that they favor, like, say, abortion rights or the right to birth control or the right to consensual sexual relations. They'll frame that within the realm of privacy rights or freedom of choice and things like that. But at the same time, liberals have their own pet peeves. You know, for example, there are liberals who think that guns are just so awful that, you know, there has to be strict gun laws. You know, even if they generally don't advocate intrusive statism as a general rule, there are liberals who say that discrimination along, you know, certain lines, whether it's race or gender or homosexual or sexual orientation, you know, that's just such an awful thing in their view that it just can't be tolerated. And that's another that's a powerful strand within liberalism. Now, beyond that, there's also the question of what about in a stateless society or a libertarian society or whatever, what about the possible presence of people with fundamentally illiberal views? You know, and when I say fundamentally illiberal views, I mean people who basically reject the traditional liberal idea of individualism that's rooted in classical liberalism and enlightenment philosophy and things like that. And there's a number of categories of people who feel that way. One, obviously, is religious fundamentalists, people who simply believe that the laws of society should be based on the laws of God or religion or whatever, as they understand it. And that you find strands like that within Christianity and Islam and Judaism, and if I knew the Asian religions better, probably those as well. That's one, religious fundamentalists. Now, in our modern societies, that is not a particularly strong force, the way it is, say, in the Middle East or something like that. But it's still there. There's still a strand to it. You know, we have a Christian fundamentalist subculture in the United States that has an extremist subculture within itself that is theocratic in nature. There is also the question of the far right, political strands that hold to fundamentally illiberal values. And of course, a lot of people, particularly Americans, I think when they hear of the far right, what they think of is the racialist right, the white nationalists and neo-fascists, neo-Nazis and things like that. And I suppose that might be considered a brand of the far right as conventionally defined. And of course, there are people within those milieus who wish to have laws that are not necessarily libertarian in nature, that are in some ways might violate the sovereignty of the individual in order to uphold what they consider to be the good of the race or the nation or something like that. For example, there are some people who do not believe that interracial marriage and things like that should be allowed. That was the norm at one point in American society. It's not at all the case now. It's a very unpopular and rarely held view at the present time. But beyond that, though, when we talk about the so-called far right, there are other systems of thinking that can come under that category that are not necessarily oriented towards racialism or neo-Nazism or that kind of thinking, but is oriented towards a very authoritarian type of communitarianism. You know, the idea that, you know, it's not the individual's rights that matter, it's society's rights that matter, and it's fine to regulate individual behavior for the good of society or perceived good of society. And that's the kind of governing philosophy that you see in some of the East Asian countries. For example, Singapore is a good example. In Singapore, it's interesting that a lot of libertarians, I've come across a lot of libertarians, at least more rightward-leaning libertarians, not so much left libertarians, who argue that that Singapore comes close to being a libertarian society. And the reason they say that is because Singapore is fairly open to trade and investment and that kind of thing. It has a rather quote-unquote liberal economy. Which, I mean, it has to because it's a city-state. It can't very well practice autocracy or, you know, autarky, rather, if as a city-state, and an island, no less. But the governing philosophy of the state of Singapore is very oriented towards the idea of authoritarian communitarianism. For instance, they use the death penalty with about as much frequency as any nation anywhere on earth, with the exception of China. I think I saw some data a few years ago that showed Singapore was second only to China in terms of per capita executions. Singapore, if they catch you with a half an ounce of heroin or cocaine, they hang you. At one point, they had a law against chewing gum. You could be fined for chewing gum in Singapore. Ironically, though, Singapore also is not a racial nationalist regime at all. It's actually a multicultural, multi-ethnic society. They actually have laws like against things like hate speech and vilification and so forth, like a lot of the more PC Western countries do. They actually have a public health care system and so forth, so they have characteristics there that a lot of leftists might actually admire. But Singapore, I just use that as an illustration, but Singapore is an example of a society that doesn't pretend to be rooted in the classical liberal tradition. I mean, they have a very authoritarian, communitarian governing philosophy. Another illiberal current that we would find in Western societies would be racial nationalist among the minority groups. For instance, there's the groups like the Nation of Islam and Afrocentric groups of that type. Many of them have views that if they were not racial minorities, would be considered on the far right. But because they're racial minorities, they're automatically identified with the left. And that is a fairly large current within some ethnic minority communities, like blacks and Hispanics and so forth in the United States. And then related to that, there's immigrant subcultures that have a lot of practices and beliefs and values that, you know, so-called liberal Westerners might raise their eyebrows at. And that's going to be more of an issue in the future, too, because of the demographic change that's coming with mass immigration. I think more and more we're going to see subcultures of immigrants that do have a lot of social practices and cultural norms and value systems that, you know, a lot of liberals and leftists in particular might raise their eyebrows at. For example, I used to have a friend of mine who had worked in the criminal justice system in Minnesota, and one of the things she used to do was facilitate classes on domestic violence and for men who had been referred to these courses by the courts. You know, these were men who'd been arrested for beating their wife or whatever and sent to these courses for, you know, about, you know, where you, you know, remedial courses on where you learn about the evils of wife beating and things like that. And she said that she was surprised at how many of these men that were sent to these courses were actually immigrants from places like the Sudan and so forth and Somalia. And they didn't understand why they were there, because they didn't understand why they were ever arrested. Their attitude was, well, my wife was disobedient, so I smacked her. Yeah, and they in their cultural norms, that's not unacceptable or abnormal. I came across another case like that where there was a community of immigrants from Laos, the Hmong people who are from the hill areas of the hill countries of Laos, the Southeast Asian nation of Laos. And a practice that some of them had, a subset of them had, was bride kidnapping. And some of them were starting to run afoul of the law for this, for bride kidnapping. And of course, there's also things like arranged marriages and clitoridectomy. And, you know, I think that will become more and more of an issue over time due to demographic change and population migration patterns and, you know, a type of culture shock that's created when, you know, groups that aren't used to being exposed to each other come in contact with each other. And another illiberal subculture we find in the United States, at least, is the gang culture. And this is an aspect of my own thinking that raises a lot of eyebrows in its own right. There are a lot of people out there who will read some of my published material, and they'll notice the references to gangs and things like that. And you know, that's probably one of the most controversial aspects of my own thinking. It's probably right up there with some of my outreach efforts to the far right, which are also very controversial. But my position is that we have to consider that in the United States there are at least 1 million gang members, which means that about 1 in 300 residents of North America belongs to a gang. Groups like the Crips, the Bloods, the Gangsta Disciples, and many MS-13s and so forth. And over time, given things like widening class divisions, population migration patterns, and so forth, gang culture will probably continue to grow. And gang culture within itself has a lot of fairly illiberal values as well. You know, these folks are not at all, you know, peace-loving, hippie egalitarians. And any viable revolutionary program for dismantling the state has to have some recognition of this and some means of either integrating these elements, these gang elements, into the wider revolutionary paradigm, or at least being able to contain them within the context of the wider society. So that's another illiberal subculture. And then, of course, there's one other one that I would have to address when we talk about the problem of groups and political currents and subcultures with illiberal values in a wider libertarian, classical liberal, anarchistic meta-system, a meta-legal system, and that's the issue of the PC left, which I really think is probably the most problematical issue, because that is a force that is rising in society. It has influence among elites. It's entrenching itself in the state to an ever greater degree. And when I talk about the PC left, I've written a lot about that. I've talked a lot about it in this broadcast, in these broadcasts from Attack the System and in past writings. And I should be clear that when I'm talking about the PC left, or what I commonly call totalitarian humanism, I'm not talking about ordinary liberals or ordinary progressives. I know a whole lot of people who would call themselves liberals, for instance, who generally have fairly libertarian values. To them, being a liberal means they're generally against aggressive war. They generally believe in civil liberties and individual privacy rights and so forth. They tend to think different people, you know, people should be treated fairly irrespective of their race or religion or gender or culture or whatever. They may not be hardcore free market type libertarians in the sense that they may be for social programs for the poor or, regulation of the environment to preserve endangered species and things of that nature. But they generally have fairly libertarian, fairly tolerant values. And in many ways, that's what the left used to be. When I was younger, I tended to be much more sympathetic to the left than the right. And the reason being that, as an American, I associated the right with the gung-ho Cold War militarists and the religious right and so forth. You know, whereas back in those days, the left tended to be more about military non-intervention and upholding the civil liberties and the, you know, due process and free speech and things like that. Now that's changed somewhat in various ways since then, but there are still a lot of people out there who think of themselves as liberal or left or progressive who have fairly decent, even fairly libertarian values. So I'm not attacking those people when I'm attacking the PC left or when I'm attacking totalitarian humanism. What I'm attacking is a much more strident and much more extreme form of leftism. That I think first started to find its way into American political culture in the 60s and 70s. And I, when I did the podcast on the New Left a few weeks back, I talked a little bit about the influence of Herbert Marcuse and his concept of repressive tolerance. And I think that a lot of the radical left now has moved towards this idea where they've essentially abandoned any real interest in things like civil liberties or individual freedom or tolerance in any honest sense. And instead, they've developed a very totalitarian, Marxism-influenced way of thinking where, you know, everything is simply about, you know, in-group, out-group conflict and, you know, just as previous generations of Marxists said that freedom was a bourgeois prejudice, and all that really mattered was the victory of the workers over the capitalists. I think a lot of today's leftists basically think that, well, you know, individual rights or freedom or civil liberties and or fair play, you know, giving other points of view a fair hearing, fair treatment of other people is not really an important value. Instead, what matters is winning the holy war against racism and sexism and homophobia and so forth. So it's all just about in-group, out-group conflict and you know, revenge against enemies and things like that. That kind of thinking seems to be very prevalent among the radical left today, and it's a rising force in our own society. It is something that's finding its way into the state to an ever greater degree. So the big issue is in a libertarian society, in a society where we aim to restructure law around the non-aggression principle, how would we go about dealing with these various you know, unlibertarian or even flagrantly illiberal subcultures and political subcurrents? And I think that the issue is obviously has to be one of decentralization. Most likely, if we could grow our own movements, our own anti-state movements to the point where we become politically dominant, we'll have to recognize that some of these subcurrents will still be there. And in a decentralized system, there may well be enclaves that form where different groups practice values and norms and even laws that are less than libertarian in many ways. You know, there may be some very conservative communities that, you know, don't allow drugs or alcohol or pornography or whatever, and there may be some super leftist communities where, every white person has to salute when they see a person of color, or, you know, some health Nazi communities where smoking, even in the privacy of your own home, is banned or whatever. And there may be enclaves in cities where gangs essentially are the local government and things of that nature. I mean, I don't know that we can ever have perfect or pure libertarianism or anarchism anymore than we can have perfect or pure anything else. Now, whenever I raise this issue, whenever I talk to people about this from different backgrounds, certainly anarchists and libertarians, and also a lot of times when I debate leftists, when I talk about how when I've debated leftists in the past, where I talk about how in a libertarian anarchist meta system, you know, there might be different kinds of communities for different kinds of people and different kinds of subcultures for different kinds of belief systems, including some that are not inherently libertarian or even anti-libertarian in many ways. You know, for example, enclaves of racial separatists may form, or religious fundamentalists, or whatever. One argument that I'll get is, well, wouldn't these kinds of communities be expansionists by nature, and wouldn't they in turn act aggressively against other communities? And of course, that's certainly a possibility. I mean, just like it's a possibility leftist communities might act aggressively against non-leftist communities. But it does get to the issue that I am interested in, and that's an issue that Carl Schmitt, you know, Carl Schmitt has been a big influence on my own thinking. And one thing that Carl Schmitt was interested in was the degree to which a society is obligated to tolerate elements within the society that seek to destroy the wider society. And what Schmitt was interested in was, in the context of the Weimar Republic, you had political movements that were trying to use democratic means to destroy the Weimar democracy, or use constitutional means to essentially overthrow the Weimar Constitution. And he was talking about the Nazi movement, and he was also talking about the communists as well, and other extremist movements from the right and left that existed at the time, and which eventually did destroy the Weimar Constitution and the Weimar Republic as we know. And my view is that there's no real easy answer to that. For example, how would a libertarian anarchist meta system, let's say that, you know, in North America or Western Europe or somewhere else, we had a federation of anarchist and libertarian communities, and then within that broader meta system, there were subversives that wished to impose communism or fascism or restore the old system, of totalitarian humanism and plutocratic capitalism. You know, to what degree would we be obligated on libertarian grounds to tolerate those elements that would destroy the system itself? And I don't think there's an easy answer to that. You know, what I think is that in a society like that, we'd probably have a militia federation. Not necessarily a state militia, a governmental militia, but something more like Hezbollah, you know, something more like a defensive force that's an agglomeration of militia organizations that are, you know, perhaps representative of the diversity of political factions that you found in the society, and that, you know, at some point, a judgment call might have to be made about, you know, to what degree a flagrantly illiberal or anti-libertarian subversive movement could be tolerated. Lots to think about. And as we can see, this concept of law and how we might go about restructuring law along libertarian and anarchistic grounds is extremely complicated. So something to think about until our next program. This is Keith Preston for Attack the System. Remember that your support, financial and otherwise, is always welcome. If you wish to offer your support, please go to the contact page at attackthesystem.com. There's a donation button there. You can donate through PayPal, or if you'd like to write to us, you can just contact us that way as well. Until next time, this is Keith Preston. See you later.